So in the reading today, we get ample evidence of the creativity of the people whose books were accepted into the Bible. I mean, can you imagine Cyrus, a pagan, saying, oh, the good Jew, we got to go build the temple again after it had been busted up? Not bloody likely. No. But then there's even a larger problem here, in that it depicts God as this vindictive son of a gun who just wants to beat people about the head and ears, you know, because they're not behaving themselves. Well, as I said a couple weeks ago, God neither punishes nor rewards. But this is just an example, and there are many in the Bible, of a kind of religious primitivism, which we find actually superseded in later books of the Bible. Okay, but their limited imagination. So today again, and I apologize, by the way, I prepared the wrong reading for last week. So if some of you were baffled by what was going on, I am the problem, not the solution in this case. Okay. The Gospel of John is a very unusual document. It was the last of the Gospels and clearly shows signs of having been redone a number of times. Some scholars think as many as 7 times. People put their hands to it and started adding stuff. And the Gospel that we have today is this kind of collation of ideas. It is also important to remember that the Gospel of John was only quoted by heretics, that is, by mistaken believers, till the end of the second century. The only people who quoted John approvingly were Gnostics and other strange types. Well, maybe they're not strange. In any case, it was very late coming into the canon, being accepted. Our Baptist friends, the biggest crowd of religious people, Protestant people in North America, love the Gospel of John. And we'll get to that. Why do they love it so much? Because if you've ever seen a Baptist talk, they have this permanent grin affixed to their face. Why? Because they're convinced they're saved already. You know? And we'll try to say something about why. Why that happens. So, and then most astonishingly, I spent some time on my highly fallible computer trying to look up a book title that struck me when I ran across it a couple months ago, The Gospel of John and the Ruin of Christianity, or something very much like that, The Destruction of Christianity. This scholar believed that with the Gospel of John, the authentic Christian message was just upended, you know, blown out of the water. And in its place, you had this kind of mystical depiction of Jesus, who never even touches the ground. You know, Jesus in John's Gospel was not baptized by John the Baptist. He didn't have agony in the garden. He knows everything. Like in that misplaced reading from last week, he knew this lady's history, this questionable lady history, without meeting her ever. You know, it's like Bush seeing into Putin's eyes and seeing his soul. I know. Well, come on. And so the reason that it was so late in being accepted is precisely this mystification, seeming mystification of Jesus by the authors of this text. He doesn't look like a real human being. And so he was much beloved by a bunch of Christians who didn't think Jesus was a real human being, as a matter of fact. He was a kind of divine spook, you know, who just pretended to walk on the ground and, well, he did walk on water, supposedly. But it was all mystification. You can't relate humanly to a person like that. I don't think I can't. So the problem, the major problem, is the the depiction of Jesus in the gospel. It is so radically different from Matthew, Mark, and Luke's depiction that people thought, this is cockamamie stuff. This can't belong here. But there's also another pervasive element in the Gospel of John, which is even more seriously troubling. I don't know whether John was a Gnostic. The Gnostics were this kind of loose grouping of Greek-thinking people who saw the world in terms of blacks and whites. Dualism, a dualistic view of the world. And you have those dualistic patterns pervading the gospel. You're from above, you're from below, you're in the light, you're in the dark, you love, you hate, you know. Over and over and over and over, you get all these contraries, you know. And the question arises, is that accurate? Is that even a helpful way of seeing the world? Of understanding ourselves? I don't think so. I want to save the author as much as I can, and there's some beautiful things like the light has come into the world, blah, 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 blah. But look at the way he argues. For all who do evil hate the light, you know. There is no intermediate stage between hating the light and coming a little bit to love the light and then loving the light, you know, full stop. But life is not like that. And it's given rise to some of the most pervasive and perverted forms of Christianity, which it took me a long time, and maybe you too, to crawl out from under, namely perfectionism. That conversion was not a process, a very gradual process, as Paul depicts it. It was kind of an upward leap, you know. You're here. No, you're here. That doesn't work. And the psychological implications of that are terrifying, and have been. And they were certainly for me. And that notion that you must be perfect pervaded my Catholic education from grade school up to the end of the seminary. When I was 26, it doesn't help people. It hands a cudgel over to these bosses who think they stand in the place of God and never can measure everybody, not themselves, of course, because they've already arrived. They can measure everybody and say, you're missing, you're out of it, you're wrong. And what is excluded in that, of course, God love him, is the thing that Francis insists upon, more than anything else, the mercy of God. There is literally no place for mercy in that scheme. Which is pretty terrifying when you think about it, at least it is to me. It destroys any notion that we find all over the Bible of the patience of God. God put up with these Jews who saw the world in black and white. The good guys are going to be rewarded by God, and the bad guys are going to be beat around the head and shoulders. Well, come on. And everybody, I think, could probably dig up examples of how perverse and destructive that is. Its nastiest instance, I suppose, is in the arrogance, however self-unconscious, of us Roman Christians toward everybody else. You're inferior, you know, you don't measure up. You've lost it somehow. And again, the fact that the very possibility of mercy is excluded in that construction of the world is terrifying. Not to say false, it is certainly false, but it does huge damage to people. I know, I've listened to enough confessions and gone through this process myself, to finally awaken to the fact that God is not going to beat you over the head if you make a single misstep. You're not perfect. And it's very clear that there's a radical contrast between this kind of perfection in this black and white world and the writings of Paul. Paul says over and over, I do not think I have won. I beat my body and bring it into subjection. Bring it. It's a process, in other words. Which is where we all are, I think. It is a process, and it gives the lie to all those religious types who are smitten by their own wonderfulness. You know, we have arrived. We have arrived. We're perfect. We're good. And all you other guys are bozos. Again, the Southern Baptists, I mean, just to show you how deep this is, this is exactly Southern Baptists believe. That's why they smile so much. However smarmy, and that's my impression, their smiles are, you know, it's phony. It does not allow us human beings to be human, which is to experiment, to win, to lose, to try, and to get up and try again, and then to get up and try again. Because you don't have to do that if you've already arrived. See? And the Gospel of John is replete with that understanding of things. I mean, as I said, there are beautiful things. I would hate for anybody to come and excise a part of the Gospel, which was clearly added much later, which is the great Last Supper discourse. You know, those three or four chapters before Jesus gets killed. They're wonderful. They're moving. You know, but they're also informed by this perverse understanding of the way the world works, the way God works. You know, God does not, in fact, operate that way. Speaking for God, if you'll allow me. But everybody's experience testifies to that fact, you know? It seems to me. And certainly self-assurance and the arrogance and we're right and everybody else is wrong has done and continues to do enormous danger to the church. I mean, we see it played out right now in the Vatican with the bishops, a number of bishops openly criticizing the Pope. Who wants a church of the poor and for the poor? We don't want that. Give me back my ermine-trimmed red velvet cape. You know, that's what I want. I want the 18 feet of the Capomania that cardinals used to go waltzing around in, you know, so they had to have all kinds of people carrying their tails. He won't have it. And also, this is probably the most dangerous thing, it is terribly off-putting to other people. You know? Where Jesus constantly insisted on the unity of us human beings, however recalcitrant we are. I mean, you embroider your position or your titles or status or not just your clothing, but the way you live and where you live and how you live, you know. What enables clericalism to flourish, as it still does, in the Roman Church? There's a very clear sense of the superiority if somebody splashes oil on my hands. When I'm ordained. Everybody has run into that, I suspect, in this room in one form or another. You know, the sense of superiority, the sense of privilege, the sense of being able to assess and judge everybody else and find them all wanting. You know? Let me finish with a little anecdote that still I can't extirpate from my head. When I was last in the States in Illinois, this creepy little Herzog University, I had the joy of serving in two farm parishes on the weekend. Because the pastor had been a pedophile, then he got kicked out, and then the bishop said, well, we get somebody else, and they virtually resurrected some 85-year-old guy, and he said, after, you'll just be here for a week or so. So after 6 months, he said, I'm packing it in. You fix this mess. So they didn't have anybody, so I was hanging around an hour away. I said, okay, Project, you jump in. Okay, which I did, and we had a great time. Those farmers and I, that was my background. But then they finally appointed a new pastor, a graduate in history from my alma mater, the University of Illinois. So I thought, oh, this ought to be really good. And then about 2 weeks later, a delegation from the parish came to see me in Quincy. They drove the hour and a half. Said, Father, we have a problem with this new priest. So they're supposed to have a parish council. And the first meeting of the parish council went like this. The new pastor came in and said, listen, if I say the sky is green and you say it's blue, the sky is still green. Imagine somebody in the 21st century saying rubbish like that. What enables that? And it's pervasive. I give you virtually any bishop in North America and talk to him for 5 minutes and you'll see, you know, that this is very much alive and kicking, this kind of sense of superiority. So pray over it. And use this as a way of examining your own life, you know. Whom do we exclude and why?